Now, the kids and I spent the better part of the past 9 months looking into ancient literature, history, our own experiences, our own culture, the zeitgeist of our times, and we compared our times and our understanding, our biased understanding of our times with representations of other eras as passed down by history through the minds of artists and philosophers like Shakespeare. The questions posed by Socrates 2,400 years ago prior to his execution by government for two charges. One was impiety, a religious indictment, in other words, government imposing religion, and two, corrupting the youth. And by corrupting the youth, if you read the four pertinent dialogues, Apology, Euthyphro, or Euthyphro, Apology, Crito, and Phaedo, you will see what I mean. You will see that corrupting the youth really boils down to inspiring the youth of a culture, the youth of a nation, the youth of a community, to think for themselves and to question the established order. This is what we were in hot pursuit of all year long. It is amazing how one can start with a long list of literary terms with the intention of teaching those terms in such a way that the kids find they are applicable to their own experiences, and that these terms help them better understand the nature of the story that is their life, their coexistential lives as social beings, living in very close proximity to other like beings, human beings, other animals, other plant life, just other things that exist in the world around you. It is fun to watch them be able to use these concepts to describe their own experiences. So much more could be said on that topic, but we need to continue on. The literary terminology then gives us a reason to take a look at a literary system or a literary theory that has withstood the test of time for the most part. It's still around. It's still a basic framework and archetype for human storytelling, both literary and historical, actually. Aristotelian tragedy is what it is called. And Aristotelian tragedy is based on Aristotle's theory that a tragedy, a play, is a very specific genre of performance art that strives to fulfill certain requirements. Those requirements are that, you know, back in these days, you know, 2,400 years ago, we're talking about times when we just have to look at history for what it was in this case and not really pass value judgments on them until a later date when we're having a different conversation. But the fact of the matter is that Aristotle articulated his rules for tragedy with a keen understanding of his own customs and conventions and opinions based on what he had been taught and what he had personally found justifiable for his world. And those rules are that the tragedy must have a protagonist, or antagonist, depending on how you look at it, but a main character who is of noble descent, and also must be male. These are two of the rules. Must be of noble descent, because if it is a story about a commoner, and the commoner does something and has a downfall, you know, depending on the position within the society, you know, most likely a peasant running into some sort of trouble is not going to reverberate throughout an empire or throughout a kingdom, because not very many people know them. Just like if I were to do something illegal that caught the attention of parents or authorities, more than likely, you know, an average ordinary teacher, it might be written up in the local newspaper, and depending on how big or salacious the allegations are, it might be propelled up to the ranks of mainstream media gossip coverage, because that's pretty much all mainstream media is good for in this day and age. But if we're talking about somebody of noble birth and noble descent, that automatically back in those days, back in the legendary days of the Oedipus legend, which is a legend that we will articulate later on, back in the early days of the Oedipus legend, which in my opinion is what really best defines Aristotle's opinion about the genre, because Sophocles, the author of Oedipus Rex, and really, in my opinion, the author of the tragic model that has persisted continuously throughout the world ever since. And there are many other cultural examples of this that come both before and after Sophocles. But back in the times of the Oedipus legend, all the way up to the times of Sophocles writing this play and reinterpreting this legend that almost everybody in the land would have some knowledge of, some experience of. It was a folk story, just like Romeo and Juliet was not originally written by William Shakespeare. Shakespeare took a pre-existing concept and just polished it to an absolutely beautiful luster. It was the most beautiful articulation of that story that anyone could hope for. It's artistic, it's brilliant, it's philosophical, it's political, it's timeless, it's archetypal. But continuing on, the tragic figure has to inhabit space in the noble caste, because if the multitudes will only be impacted if it is a mistake made on a gigantic level, and the downfall of the figure results in some sort of a catastrophic downfall or societal failure and collapse. Another rule is that this tragic hero, somewhere in the narrative, always needs to, or always makes a mistake. And that mistake, we are going to spend time defining exactly what we mean by mistake, in the context of the ancient Greek use of the term and of the word, with their biases and their subtleties, implied meanings that people 2,400 years later simply don't have access to, but by close, careful study of the writings from that actual era. So this mistake is not actually, it's multifaceted. It's making a philosophical mistake out of ignorance. It is being overconfident. It's a personality problem. It is something called hubris. It is a Greek concept called hubris, and the word hubris literally means overconfidence, or some sort of a divine, profound overconfidence in the ability of the self, or the importance or standing of the human being within the universe, that whenever we transcend our boundaries, whenever we go too far, beyond what we can handle or beyond what we ought to handle. We should know better, in other words. We should have the wisdom to know that while we can do something, we shouldn't because of the catastrophic consequences. This is the nature of the mistake, that the hero becomes hubristic. The hero becomes overconfident and learns the hard way by eating crow. Another rule is that by the end of the play, the tragic hero becomes the tragic hero by not simply rolling over in defeat and expiring as one of the villains of history. The tragic hero does the incredible. He admits to himself and to the public that his downfall was his fault and that the sufferings caused in the aftermath of the downfall were direct results of his doing. This is the stage called pity and fear. Aristotle says that in order for a tragic hero to be effective and for the tragic play in and of itself, which is defined as a story or poem that follows the rules that I am describing right now. But it's that Aristotle says that in order for the play to be effective, much like, you know, medication needs to have certain impacts or certain effects on the body in order to be considered an effective medication, an effective tragedy evokes feelings of both pity and fear in the spectator. The essential component to the play, the bedrock upon which the play exists, the reason for the performance in the first place. That spectators need to feel pity in the sense that they look and see that this tragic hero, wow, had a horrible downfall. Yes, it is his fault. But wow, you can see that though he had good intentions, he meant well, he tried to do his best. It just so happens that some misunderstanding, some mistake, some sort of a character flaw, a personality disorder, an addiction, you know, some sort of idiosyncrasy that results in hubristic tendencies caused his downfall, and he acknowledges this, and he accepts responsibility, and then, and only then, does he become the tragic hero, because it is after the nature of the tragic flaw is discovered that the person can make a choice. And that is what heroism always boils down to, a choice that a human being must make at some point in this context, his life. And the choice, once the protagonist comes to this understanding that it is indeed his fault, the choice that he must make boils down to this. Do I give in and accept defeat and allow myself to wither away and be destroyed? In other words, take the easy way out. Oh, I failed. I'm done. I'm too embarrassed. I don't want to exist anymore. Or do you make the choice to do the right thing, even though you have just been completely obliterated? And it's your own fault. The hero always makes the choice to right the wrongs and then sets sail. True heroism. In the face of failure, you resurrect yourself and you become the true hero that everybody always knew you were. Because everybody makes mistakes. Everybody falls. This is the basic pattern for all human stories. The plot arc starts out with the exposition, explaining the nature of the world and the nuances of the world. We then find ourselves embroiled in some sort of a conflict, some sort of an issue that must be explored, analyzed, and ultimately, hopefully, resolved. Once the conflict is understood, the investigation is underway, and in the story, you keep on learning more and more and more and more and more and more in a rising storyline that tells you everything you need to understand how the story ties up its loose ends, which is when you then get to the next stage, which is the climax of the story, when once and for all, what you've been looking for on the whole ride, whether it is a romance novel or a history book, you see the culmination as it is in the story, may it be fiction or our understanding of history. And then, once you see that resolution, you taper off. The action slows. Loose ends are tied up. And then you resolve and decay, and the story is its own self-contained arc. And then one can assume that the story continues as time unfolds. That said, there are certain things that all human beings have in common. Number one, we all require sustenance. Number two, we all require shelter. Number three, we all require companionship. And as my students taught me this year, as my students convinced me this year, number four, you need, and I believe this is a part of companionship, so I'm still going to roll this into the three essentials, because I like the number three, trilogies. It is mental stimulation from companions. Can you get some mental stimulation from the world? Of course. But a human being needs its own kind. From birth, a human being needs its own kind. Every now and then you find somebody who is completely reclusive, but you'll also see that we have this word recluse to describe aberrant behavior. It's not typical. Most people are social beings. And even the genuine recluses with whom I have a lot of with whom I identify in some ways. Not completely, obviously. I'm a teacher. But mental stimulation is absolutely crucial. We need validation. We need help. We can't do it all on our own. We can, but it's hard. At that point, your daily obligations are pretty much reduced to the idea that you, the purpose of your life is maintaining the physical and autonomic processes of physical being, and that in the end, the soft stuff, the fluffy stuff, the personality and psychological stuff, the artistic stuff, the imaginary stuff, that all of that somehow takes second seat. And for some people, that might be their desire, but for most, it's not. And we often get hung up on things that really, when it comes down to it, we do not require for survival. Religion, for example, is very important and has played a very important role in the lives of billions of people for the duration of our existence thus far. But as the Dalai Lama wisely says, we need to get to a point where, while we can understand that cultures have different opinions and different beliefs, that that's okay. And that as long as the person has the freedom to voice his or her personal belief systems, without fear of persecution or retribution, that you are upholding the highest ethic articulated by mankind to date, which is the purpose of human life is to help others by cultivating a wise and compassionate and kind and warm self. And if you can't help a person in need, at least don't harm them. If you do this, you follow the teachings of the Buddha. You follow the teachings of Jesus himself. Not the institutions created by power-hungry people after his life. True Buddhists understand the teachings of their teacher. True Christians walk in the wise footsteps of Christ. So when it comes to opinions about how the world was created, I suggest that it is time to start looking for the commonalities between the religions before we work so hard to contrast them and to debate who is right. Because in the end, if you really truly read the original stories as they are passed down, or as close as you can get to the original tellings, from what little we have from ancient times, you will see that the themes are pretty common. You have to deal with situations as they are in your times. That true heroes make choices to better themselves by bettering the world and the lives of those around them. Otherwise, you are villainous. You are a tyrant. You are a slaveholder. You are an abuser. And you're the worst kind of abuser. The passively tolerant or passively intolerant. Followers of psychopaths like Adolf Hitler, Henry Kissinger, and hundreds, thousands of other tyrants who were able to manipulate the well-intending people of the world in such a way that they were complicit in the greatest crimes against humanity that our species has ever seen. Those who do not understand history are doomed to repeat it. I suggest that it's time to prove to the world that the human species can move beyond the carnage and bloodshed of the 20th century and most of the centuries preceding it all around the globe, and that we can once and for all realize that our differences are exactly the things that make us strong and that make life interesting, and that it would be far more entertaining and productive to start dialogues between cultures that satiate our curiosities and prove demonstrably that we all have more commonalities than differences, and that differences in opinion are illusory, and that reality is what we make of the time we are given in our given context, which happens to be the only stage upon which the human drama has ever unfolded, the earth.